This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, and you're very welcome to this week's Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh. I'm, of course, joined by Tillage Editor Andy Doyle, and we have all the latest tillage news for you this week. Coming up, we'll talk field work, straw incorporation measures, maize imports. Andy has all of the details from the National Potato Conference, and, of course, we'll have the usuals, grain markets and weather. Andy, speaking of weather, there is bits of work going on, there's bits of beet coming out. Someone on the phone there said they saw a bit of sowing going on. So despite all the rain, people are able to get some bit of work done.
Yes, indeed, Siobhan. I was out on land yesterday, and in the course of the day, it was a good day. There was certainly no showers and there was reasonable drying. And in the course of the day, you could see the land drying that bit under your feet. A combination of soakage and drying, it's fair to say. Not massive drying, as in the land didn't turn white like that, but certainly there was no difficulty being on it, and it was quite solid underfoot. So I think a lot of people will be watching that in terms of trying to get machinery out on land, in particular to catch up on essential spraying, be it herbicides and or insecticides for some people. So I think people will be watching like hell, and in particular the few wet spots in the field. Like relatively recently, people were out and they made quite a mess in some fields, almost everywhere. Now, or in a day or two's time, perhaps they might be able to get through the bulk of the tram lines without virtually marking them, and maybe only have an odd bad spot here and there just to get work done.
I haven't seen much spraying going on, Andy, but I suppose, look, if you can travel, you know, it's important to try and get out. The earlier you get out with those herbicides for grass weeds in particular, the earlier you get out, the better.
Yeah, you know, they're strongest at their residual stages, the things that we might be using this time of the year. And it's arguably still early for any of the contacts, because you couldn't guarantee that everything that you want to kill will be there at this point in time, particularly on later sown crops. It's just the challenge that's always there, trying to get the timing right.
And I suppose, Andy, crows like are always a big concern at this time of the year. If people can travel, crows are probably the main thing that's putting them off. Where's the balance on that? Sure.
That's a real big challenge, Siobhan. And I think the only way that people can read that is history. It's ironic that I remember the last few seasons, people remarking about the relatively little damage that crows done to crops that were sown well into November. And that's probably helped by warmer temperatures. But as I look into the forecast for the next number of weeks, in as much as you can read them accurately, There's a good bit of frost in the forecast, and that would suggest that other sources of food may become more difficult, and therefore the crops and the seeds we plant could be at greater risk. Like, it's interesting talking to farmers. There's lots of people I talk to in the south, and they say no, they're packing it in because of the risks that they perceive. While if I go to the other end of the country, or more than halfway up, and I get into parts of North Leinster where there's an awful lot less trees, people have always planted late in the autumn and gotten away with it, and they're still doing that this year. And they will still. I would be surprised if we don't see more planting being done this week.
And I suppose in the next few weeks, Andy, people will move to beans as well. And, you know, winter beans are getting more attractive to grow. So if soil conditions do clean up, look, at risk of crows again. But I think winter beans are becoming, they're definitely becoming more of an attractive crop for people to grow. I just noticed, like, from 21 to 22 last year, they almost doubled in acreage, I think. So there was about 590 hectares sown in 2021, and that went to over 1,000 in 2022. So I suppose varieties and things are helping there, and people might try to get out with them now in the next few weeks.
And people are trying to spread the workload as well. I think on winter beans, people acknowledge the fact you can't guarantee a higher yield. But in one of the recent years, they have actually done quite well in comparison to the spring crop. And it's a crop that's sown at a time when you might not be planting anything else. And as long as you can get them down that 3+ inches, most crops have been pretty full when it comes to emergence in springtime.
Yeah.
So, crows, while they're a big risk, have not been a major problem with modern drilling techniques, particularly with strip-till drilling. And crops have been safe because of that. And that's a good thing. And people are kind of pulling on the hopping ball, I suppose, and at least trying them once to see how they go.
Yeah. And there's that advantage that, you know, come harvest time, you know, they might have 10 days or 2 weeks on the spring beans. And those 10 days or 2 weeks could make a big difference when it comes to harvest weather at that time of year.
Yeah, can do. I was actually surprised, Siobhan. I was down at the CAP meeting in Kerry. Is it last week now or the week before?
Last week, I think, Andy, yeah.
Yeah, well, look, I was talking to people who still have beans to harvest.
Okay.
And I'm kind of wondering to myself, where did the opportunity go? And when you stop and think about it, there's been so much bad weather in that part of the country for the last 6-8 odd weeks. That it could happen that people didn't have an opportunity to harvest a spring sown crop, particularly if it was anything like later sown in spring. So, there is a risk. You can't push the boat out too far at either end. While a few people this year would have harvested spring beans before winter beans, that's not the norm. And I'm not sure if we were comparing like with like. It's completely possible if a bad spring crop was harvested before a good winter crop. And I don't know whether that was the case or not, but I would kind of think that it was likely to be the case.
Yeah, weather conditions did get very hard, very difficult to harvest those beans. And a lot of beans could have high moistures in the end up as well. So understandable on how it could happen. I suppose another thing to mention on beans, Andy, the protein payment is going to go up next year in the new cap. So it's going to be a minimum of €350 per hectare. So, I mean, that's going to give people a bit of confidence to sow as well. And it's definitely something we should have in our minds going into 2023.
Yes, indeed, Siobhan. And I think the underlying thing there, maybe the bigger factor, is that the threshold area that's to be supported is going from 12,000 hectares to 20,000 hectares. Mm-hmm. Now, we've managed to get the bean supported area up to about 13.5 or thereabouts, if I remember correctly. So that's the highest it's ever been. So if we were to only have, say, 13,000 hectares of beans next year, the aid support would be considerably above the 350 base figure that you're talking about. So again, it could prove to be a very lucrative crop, and I would certainly be recommending people to do it for two reasons. One would be that the aid might be there, but an even bigger reason would be the savings that you can generate in your overall nitrogen bill by having a crop that doesn't require any nitrogen. Yes, it requires P and K. And as well as not requiring any nitrogen for 2023, you should realistically be applying less nitrogen to the following crop in 2024. And no matter what the price of nitrogen in 2024, that's still a saving or a bonus to the following crop.
Yeah.
And that's more money in our pockets. And people should just need to be conscious and aware of those things and the benefit of what rotation actually brings.
Good points there on beans, Andy. Other field work that I'm seeing, Andy, a lot of this weather is field work that shouldn't be going on. And that's slurry bean spread. There's an awful lot of slurry bean spread around the country. And, you know, aside from the rules that are there, I mean, it's just been so wet. Like, not only is that slurry that's being spread a big risk to water, but it's nutrients down the drain, like literally nutrients down the drain. But Andy, we talk a lot about nitrates on this podcast, and it's very frustrating, I'd say, for tillage farmers to see these people out spreading slurry outside of the allowed time periods when tillage is being hit with such, you know, is being hit with such measures like the stubble cultivation this year and all the other added regulations that are coming in. Like it's a bit hard to take at times, isn't it?
It is, Siobhan. It most certainly is. I mean, you know, we're all very conscious and have been for some time that there are rules and regulations that have to be adhered to. And while we all disagree with them, you know, when it was obligatory to cultivate all stubbles last autumn, people cultivated all stubbles.
Yeah.
When the rules changed, they took a view and they said, well, OK, I'm not going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm planting this catch crop or whatever. So in the main, we've adhered to all the regulations or virtually all the regulations around nitrates to the point that, you know, I would question whether or not an amount of the loss that's been attributed to tillage is actually coming from tillage. But to know that there are other elements of agriculture that are blatantly ignoring the rules that apply to them in a scenario where the risk to water and water quality is much higher than for anything that occurs out of tillage. It's not just frustrating, it is bloody annoying that it's happening that way. And sometimes, you know, I hear people remarking, are we just being made the simple scapegoat because we are not up abusing the rules that we're being given?
Yeah, it's frustrating to see. And, you know, as you said, Andy, tillage farmers were proactive. The stubble cultivation rules, you know, were frustrating. But at the same time, as you said, people adhered to them. If anything, they went over and above. Like we had an article in the paper there. Walter Furlong was speaking at one of our events and he said that cover crop sowings in their area, in the Cooney Furlong area, went from 8,000 acres to 16,000 acres. So when people were doing their stubble cultivation, they threw in a cover crop with it, you know, so doing really good things for nitrates. So look, we'll move on from it, but frustrating to see it going on. Other things going on this week in the news, Andy, another scheme, the strong corporation measure. We got figures there into the Farmers Journal this week on the areas of those crops. Look, we had them before, but going into the time when we're going to be paid, those payments are going to be issued for the strong corporation measure in December. So we got more accurate figures from the department. The department have said they're still subject to change, but they've increased from the last time we published them. So in total, 52,715 hectares of straw was chopped under the scheme. And the highest area there, probably not surprising, winter oilseed rape, was at 11,139 hectares, spring barley at 10,724, and winter wheat at 10,053 hectares. So, look, a positive scheme this year, Andy. Probably a lot of people kicking themselves that they didn't chop more, and we know that a lot of people did chop outside of the scheme as well.
Yeah, Siobhan, I was surprised and yet not surprised at the relatively high number for spring barley. You know, with 10,000 odd hectares being chopped, because it is, I suppose, one of the more lucrative straw crops. But as against that, there are lots of people who have encountered such great difficulty in trying to either sell or have straw moved that in theory has been sold in latter years, that they're just saying, no, it's not worth the trouble anymore. And I think more and more people are also beginning to see the very substantial advantages that chopped straw brings to stubbles, probably within a year or two, where, you know, you can go from having a very miserable headland to having quite an open headland with a good, what appears to be a good crop growing on it. And as I travel the country at the moment, and I see winter crops emerging and some headlands, you know, almost classifiable as disaster areas, I stop and think, you know, what would that headland look like if its straw had been incorporated on the headland alone for the past number of years? And I'm pretty certain it would be open and not look like that. You know, a far better chance to water, for water to get away when you're incorporating straw. Because basically you see an improvement in structure that allows for better drainage. And if you have better drainage, you'll have better crop survival and you'll probably have better crop performance, unless the fertility is all wrong.
Yeah. Andy, like, people seeing the benefits and probably, look, going on this year at the minute, you'd say there's going to be more straw chopped next year. But we actually had a budget of 15 million euro last year. And the budget for the next, it was 10 million the year before that, in the first year of the scheme. But for the next 5 years of the cap, the funding is 10 million per year. Now, I'd say that the department have kind of said before that, look, if the straw scheme is oversubscribed, the money will come from somewhere else. But, you know, we might be facing into a situation next year where that scheme could be oversubscribed.
Yes, Siobhan. And again, I've had some of the same conversation with people in the department. And yes, if it's at all possible to find the funding to pay for the oversubscribed people, then that will happen. But if not, they will have their homework done as to whether or not individuals will actually be accepted into the scheme based on the priorities that were outlined in the scheme for 2021.
So in that case, like, winter oilseed rape would be the first crop to go out of that scheme. But as far as I'm aware, if you have oats to be chopped as well, so if you have oats and winter oilseed rape, your winter oilseed rape will get into the scheme. So look, we might be talking about a situation that would never happen, but probably good to bring it up all the same. Like, that 10,000 hectares or nearly 11,000 hectares of spring barley that was chopped, you know, that scheme is probably very important for those farmers. They're probably in areas where spring barley is, you know, is a predominant crop. Maybe they're far away. I'm thinking of areas like Wexford, where they're far away from the straw market. And, you know, it'd be a pity to see those people not able to chop their spring barley, I suppose.
Yes, Siobhan, I think, you know, I would sum it up exactly the same as you. They're the people that have been frustrated by the market for the vast number of years, or the last number of years. But if you're a spring barley only producer in the coming year, you may not actually get into the scheme. That was not the case this year or last year, because they were not oversubscribed. But based on how the thing is to work, if you only had that one crop, but if you have oats, and this is kind of something that people have to think of, if you have oats, I think you're almost guaranteed to get entry. Not guaranteed, but nearly guaranteed to get entry if you're going to chop oat and straw to start with. And then you can chop whatever amount of barley straw you might wish to do after that. And it's important that people know that as they're planning their crops for the year ahead.
Yeah, because if we're looking at it from another point of view, you know, if those people are growing spring barley year in, year out, they might be on the, you know, they might be growing cover crops as well to get around the other rules, the crop diversification. Like, you know, maybe that ground would benefit from the straw. And as well, they're the people who probably should be chopping the straw from a market point of view, because, you know, we often see the straw in those areas. And, you know, the bottom is just falling out of the market in those areas, you know, and as a result of that scheme, that scheme is helping to hold up the market. So if that straw isn't chopped, you know, the market is, I suppose, is not going to be as stable as well.
Yeah. And Siobhan, look, at in those same areas, it certainly has been common in the past to hear of prices of straw at 12 euro a bale, lower as well, but just take 12. At 12 euro for the bale, that's roughly 8 euro for the straw. Indeed, arguably 7.50, depending on whether you're paying 4 or 4.50 for baling. But let's just say it's 8. And at 10 bales to the acre, which is a reasonable amount of straw, that's only 80 euro. and the chopping scheme is wants to pay you 20. Now, I know there are costs associated with chopping. The diesel on the combine is one, and the cost of incorporation is another. But the cost of incorporation, if you use incorporation to also sow a catch crop, and you're using incorporation as a way to try and grow out some of your weed bank, you know, the actual cost of incorporation spread across three jobs becomes very good value for money. So I don't think that it's necessarily right to put all the cost of cultivation against incorporating the straw when it has so many other very advantageous side effects along the way. So I think that for many of those people, being able to chop and catch crop simultaneously, that is really good husbandry for the long term. And you're certainly soaking up any additional nitrogen that's in the ground with the double soakage of the straw to be rotted and the crop to grow. And if you can, if you're chopping, then you should be able to sow your catch crop, maybe a week, maybe even 2 weeks earlier. And that has the potential to grow a lot more vegetation and to capture a lot more of the nutrient that might otherwise be lost. So it's massively win-win in that scenario.
Yeah. Look, definitely a positive scheme anyway, and a very welcome scheme. And look, hopefully people continue to take it up. The full figures are in the news pages this week for each of the crops. Also in the news pages, related to that, we're talking about straw and storing carbon. There's some stories in there on new carbon removal proposals that came into the EU today, Wednesday. Sorry, I should have said it at the start of the podcast. We're recording on Wednesday evening. So there's an update on those proposals in the news pages. But look, no clarification on how farmers would be paid for carbon if they were to be paid for it. Moving on, Andy, tillage pages. We spoke about the Bodatio conference last week, but I suppose you're getting into some of the more technical detail on the pages this week.
Yeah, a bit more technical and a bit more on the changes that have happened in the chip market, because I think we barely mentioned it last week, but I have long been of a view that virtually all chippers had been using imported potatoes. But a Borbia survey indicated that the people who buy the chips were always of a view that they were buying Irish potatoes, and many were shocked that was not the case. So bit by bit, actions by, in fairness, IFA, individual chippers, and now Borbia have acted to try and improve the source of supply of Irish potatoes to family-run chippers. And it's actually been quite successful. It's still in its infancy in terms of the total market. But you can probably now go into a chipper and see signs up to say that this chipper is selling Irish potatoes, and probably name the local supplier of those potatoes. So again, we're taking agriculture back into a circular economy, keeping it local, and adding to the whole sustainability of the different elements of the industry, just because we're not burning huge amounts of diesel and rubber and whatever else, moving stuff from A to B. So I'm kind of delighted to be able to report on that and the achievements that have been made by a number of them. And there's some of those chippers now in quite a number of different counties. I didn't name them because I didn't catch all the names in the presentation, but it's just so lovely to see that it's going on. And one of the things, Siobhan, that I might just mention in passing is that a lot of that interaction between the grower and the chipper is being done on a one-to-one basis. So it's not a financial partnership, but it's a business partnership where one depends on the other. And that brings about a whole different set of respect and a whole different set of obligations that each feels for the other. So that if something has gone wrong during the year, that the grower thinks that he would not be able to meet the requirements because the season is wrong for to produce a good chipping potato. Well, you know, that conversation happening regularly with the chipper owner would have the chipper owner on standby to try and source potatoes elsewhere for that season, if that's what was to happen, or even for the volume of supply that we mightn't be able to keep them going for as many months as we did previously. But interestingly, when one of the chipper owners, Dario McCarry, was speaking at the conference, he said price in my arrangement has not been an issue. He said it's the quantity that's the issue. I just need more potatoes of Irish origin. And, you know, he needs more. And if more chippers need more, it hopefully would be opening up new opportunities, at very worst, to displace the pretty big quantity of imported potatoes that fills that market currently. So that's a good thing. I also spoke about, or I'm writing about, the evolution in potato blight, which is and remains a scourge for all potato farmers. And the fact that we see new strains coming that are more and more difficult to kill. We see resistance coming to more and more of the commonly used actives in the market. And we see older and very useful actives being removed from the market due to EU legislation. And when you have all of these things happening simultaneously, all you see is a bigger problem with blight going into the future. Now, having said that, basically the only other tools that we have to lean harder on would be the whole integrated pest management suite of tools that are there. Now, there are not that many in it, but one of them certainly is the ability to predict when blight will not be a problem, in as much as when it will be a problem. And for the last couple of seasons, a new warning system is being developed between Teagasc and Metairn, being developed and tested. And for the last couple of seasons, it's been obvious to the researchers involved that we could actually have saved on the number of sprays we apply. And in a number of instances, we could also have saved on the quantity of product to be applied per application, because the risk was perceived to be very low for some of those. So it's interesting to see these new tools coming to give more accurate advice and the potential for saving. It's only a potential. It won't always be there depending on the weather. But it's important to know when there are windows in our blight control cycle where a blight spray might not be needed if blight infection has not already taken place in a crop. So it was terrific to hear those developments being talked about. And okay, the quick last one that's there, Siobhan, is on the relative to the cost of electricity and the cost of storing potatoes. It's running these big massive refrigerated stores is a very expensive operation. And there was advice there on what individual growers can do to try and maximize the efficiency of their stores. And I reported on some, not all of that, because people get some of that from their own independent personal advisors as well.
Yeah, there was lots at the potato conference, Andy, anyway. And people can read about it on the tillage pages this week. There's lots more detail than you've given there. So thanks for that, Andy. We'll move on to grain price, I think. So as I look now, so it's Wednesday, 30th of November, recording in the evening time. Prices are in the green at the minute on Matif wheat, Andy. But look, they're up and down, aren't they?
Yes, Siobhan. When we started this call, we'd been both talking about them, and I wondered, was the market active today? Because the vast majority of positions read zero, as in there had been no kind of major change today. But that's not something that kind of stays stable for that long. I'm glad to see, yes, they are in the green. And as I look at it today, the last trade was at 3.28, up 2 euro. On last night's close. But there's a bit of volatility. It's not massive volatility, but if I talk about it, really, we're talking about prices kind of running from 3.25 to 3.30. That's kind of the trading band that has been there for the last week odd. It got a little bit below that at times, and arguably got a little bit above it at times, but that's pretty much the band that it's trading in. And, you know, some of that is there because there has been a lot of imports kind of locked in. And also the extension of the grain export corridor through the Black Sea for Ukrainian grain is added to the confidence on the supply side, which almost automatically adds to the negative on the demand and price side. Because if there's more than enough supply, then the people who want it, no, they don't have to be kind of trying too hard to get it, that there will be more there regardless of what happens. And you know, if you stand back and put yourself in the shoes of the people that have been making feed for the last 12 months odd, you know, they've seen an awful lot of very expensive grain feeds, not just grains, but feeds come into their mills, and they haven't been rewarded for that in terms of the value that they can get from the feed going out, because there was limited capacity to pay, particularly in markets like the pig market, for a lot of that time. So, you know, you stand back and you have sympathy for where they come from. But at this point in time, they seem to be in the driving seat. That might not continue, but that's where it looks to be for the moment. You know, time will tell whether or not we'll see prices weaken further, maintain or strengthen further. But the one comment, Siobhan, that I would want to make is that, you know, for the first time in a long time now, we've seen December 23 prices, which we're now talking about the crop that we have planted, are going to plant in the springtime, with dry prices there coming in well under 300 euro a ton. Yeah. Which would put green prices, I think, if I remember it, did I see Glanbia with a green price of something like 250 a ton for green barley for next harvest earlier this week? Okay. You know, this is what these numbers are now doing. We have to be conscious of the fact that they are quite real in terms of what the market is talking about. Indeed, yeah. I actually think I'll step it out in a second, or correct it in a second. I actually think that may even have been lower. It was 235 for barley.
Yeah.
And 245 for wheat. Yeah.
We're at 293 there on Matif wheat for December. So yeah, not surprising then on those prices. Andy, with can at 850, like, those prices aren't making sense. You know, people have to sit down and do the books in the, you know, in this wet weather, they need to sit down and work out what they need to do in order to make a profit in the coming season. Like, it's not making sense if you're buying Canada at 50.
100% correct, Siobhan. And even for those people with winter grain already in the ground and there's spotty crops all over the place, you know, how do you justify going to optimum rate even in those type of crops when there are so many blank spaces in it, because we don't have the capacity to not put nitrogen on the blank spaces. So you know that the yield potential is automatically limited by those spaces. So there's a lot of hard questions to be asked. In spring of this year, we had the same conversation, Siobhan,
and
we know that people were thinking seriously and they didn't lock into their full supply of nitrogen, whatever source of nitrogen they were using. They actually cut back by 50 and 20%. Yeah. But then as grain prices rose, they were given the confidence to go back out with more nitrogen because the crops were full and the yield potential looked to be there. And we know that with the benefit of hindsight, that yield potential was delivered. But next spring is going to have much more difficult decisions to be made.
Yeah, and factor in convergence and the new CAP 2023. You know, when you're doing your books and your crops, you know, think about your CAP calculator there as well. Because there's big changes coming from tillage. It's all well and grand. We hear of the minister talking about an increase in tillage area, but it's very difficult to do and to see happening when we look at prices like that. And at the same time, Andy, like, you know, huge amounts of maize coming into the country. We had it there online this week and it'll be in the paper as well. You know, since May now, we've basically been at 120,000 tons of maize or more. 119,655 tons came in May. That rose to 156,700 in June. And we've been over 120,000 tons of maize coming in each month in July, August and September. Like, that's worrying, isn't it? And especially for people who have grain in their sheds.
Yes, it is, Siobhan. It's actually quite worrying. The only thing that we would say is that an amount of that maize was probably bought at prices that makes it look expensive today relative to the price of Irish grain. But the value or the price being put on Irish grain today is also a lot lower than the price that was actually purchased for that harvest, or that people thought it was worth when they were putting it in the store. So either way, anybody with grain in shed that is not finding a way to direct consumption within that business is probably now proving to be an expensive asset or an expensive element of feed. And, you know, that's going to be carried, or has to be carried within the system. But if you bring in a million plus tons of maize and you quickly get up to a million, when you start adding up the type of numbers that you're talking about, Siobhan, that's a million tons that may not be there, or a chunk of a million tons that may not be there for Irish grains. But maize is only one of the feeds that's been brought in. Like, there's lots of other things also been brought in big quantities that will displace Irish grain in rations. And, you know, I'm hearing at the moment that one of the problems and pressures in the market is that in an effort to try and sell and cover their bases, some people are just now trying to move grain on. And if you're trying to move grain on to buyers who don't particularly want it, the only way you can move it is to discount it. And once you start discounting, you keep discounting. And that's part of what's going to happen there in the market going forward.
Yeah, talking about other grains, like wheat imports for January to September are at 173, nearly 174,000 tons. You know, that's compared to down around 134,000 in 2020 and 2021. Barley is at 138,000 tons. Look, that's close enough to the 2021 and 2020 figures. But look, plenty of other things coming in as well, you know, soya and whatever else it may be. But something to keep an eye on anyway.
Joanne, just before we leave it, I think just to make a comment that the background behind this is that all of a sudden the market feels that the overall supply on grains, particularly wheats, maybe less so maize, that the overall supply is now bigger than what they perceive the market demand will be. And that supply is certainly helped and dependent on access to Ukrainian grains. That may or may not happen. There's lots of opportunity for problems to occur there, either directly in the war, or indeed there are already problems that are happening with the inspection, the rate of inspection going through the Bosphorus, going through Istanbul in particular. Because the Turks are checking the boats, and I'm hearing of bigger and bigger and bigger queues of boats waiting to get through, and that is significantly decreasing the throughput and export potential from the Ukraine. Like, the if I just give two numbers that I have in the back of the paper, the AHDB in the UK indicate that in October there were 4.2 million tons of grains exported from Ukraine. In November, the figures aren't final yet because the month isn't gone, but in November they reckon that will be closer to 3 and maybe even below 3 million tons because of the slowness of the pace of ships getting in and out. So, you know, you, if that continues for a couple of months, well, then there's a few million tons that won't be in the market. And I just get the feeling that Ukrainians hint, maybe is a better way to say it, that the Russians are pressuring the Turks to slow the pace of clearance in the hope that buyers will be left with no opportunity other than to buy more Russian grain, because there would appear to be an ongoing reluctance in a lot of countries to buy Russian grain. So, you know, nothing is as simple as it seems to be.
Yeah. Andy, time is against us, so we'll move on to weather. You have the forecast there for the coming week.
I have, Siobhan, and it's not as pleasant a mystery as I thought it was going to be, or I'd hoped it was going to be. But all in all, it's still not a very bad forecast. Ironically, it would seem like there is certainly a good bit of rain in the forecast for the east of the country in particular. But the east of the country has got away light for the last number of weeks in comparison, you know, an inch and a quarter over the week, with Sunday being the very wet day across the east and the southeast, according to the forecast, with virtually no rain in other parts of the country on the same day. West Midlands, Southwest have relatively little rain in the forecast, Northwest as well, relatively little rain in the forecast for the next week. Quite a number of zeros in the forecast there. So with ones, twos and threes kind of written down for individual days, there certainly could be an opportunity across parts of the south to maybe get some work done. But if you want to do work on the East Coast, I would say get it done before this week, if at all possible. It'll be a bit more awkward for the first half of next week, it looks like.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Temperatures,
for that,
just before I leave it to on temperatures, wind speeds generally not nearly as high as they were, so maybe less opportunity for the drying that we've seen in recent days. And temperatures for this week falling again, but next week most definitely falling, kind of going back to 5 and 6 maximum temperatures daytime and going down to -1 and 2 at night. So I think we will see the chill starting to come, and we will see a definite slowness in emergence for any crops that will be planted from here on in.
Yeah, no harm for aphid numbers though, all the same.
No, but it still probably doesn't do away with the need to try and knock down the numbers that are there if you're in a place where the aphids are a regular problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that, Andy, and thanks as always to you for listening, and to Claire and Jerome for editing back at base. So until next week, keep the tillage flag flying.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.